I'm Justin Oldham, and you're listening to another Politics and Patriotism podcast.
This is our time.
Haven't we heard this somewhere before?
This is our time.
Anybody who votes should be skeptical.
How's that hopey-changey stuff working out for you?
Voting is one of the most important things you can do.
Okay, let's make this quick. I got a hot dog in the microwave.
Hey, think for yourself and don't be fooled by the spin.
I understand your frustration and your cynicism.
Your sense of right and wrong is the only thing that keeps them in check.
You never want a serious crisis to go to waste.
Disagree with me if you must, but at least have the presence of mind to tell me why.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Watch your language, you bud. We're on the air.
We're talking today with Martin Bain, co-host of the very famous Above Politics show here in the United States. And so Martin, I would like to ask you directly, since you live in Britain, what are going to be the impacts of these defense cuts?
I suppose in essence, fairly traumatic if you sort of work in the defense industry. You're a soldier, a sailor, an airman, or something involved in the military. Actually, just boil it down to be absolutely direct back to you, Justin. It's current spending is going to be cut by 7.5%, and capital spending down 7.5%, and that's on a £46 billion budget, which is probably going to be in the region of $70 billion. So yeah, fairly substantial cuts. And the sort of highlights here are the RAF and the Navy will lose 5,000 posts each, the Army 7,000, and the Ministry of Defence will lose 25,000 civilian staff. There are some other notable cuts, which I must confess, I'm not entirely convinced by some of them. One of the, I suppose, the big one that sort of sparked some controversy here, Justin, was the aircraft carrier Ark Royal is going to be axed. They use the word immediately, but I think you and I both know in military terms, you can't just say, I'm going to stop using an asset. It's going to take, I suspect, at least 6 to 9 months to wind Ark Royal down, and then, you know, potentially use the nice generic phrase of it will be mothballed. The other thing that will also do is potentially take away some of our Harrier jump jet force. So potentially the only military in the world using jump jets would probably be the US Marines and the UK RAF. So I'm inclined to disagree with that one a little bit. And then the other big one, and I'm still not sure what we're going to do about them, and they've decided not to take an upgraded version of the Nimrod spy plane. I sort of guess that all these cuts lead to one thing, which is it's going to mean closer working with your allies, and I suspect the UK will no longer be a force that will want to just go off and do things on its own. I mean, the last time we seriously did that was in 1982 with the Falklands War. If today a similar incident happened, Justin, I'd have to think that we couldn't actually go 8,000-9,000 miles from the United Kingdom to the South Atlantic and mount a, you know, what at the time many people thought was a military operation that was doomed to failure, but actually, you know, was absolutely successful, met all its military objectives and all its political objectives. So I think it's going to mean that we will be the I'm going to use a phrase and hopefully no one's going to mind. I think we're just going to be the bitch of the US for the foreseeable future. Whatever the US want to do, we will, if it suits our own political needs and is expedient for us to continue to be closely involved with US foreign policy, we'll continue to operate fairly closely with the US and take advantage of its vastly greater assets. And and potentially where we don't have assets, we're going to probably offer things that they don't have. And I suspect some of the things that we can offer potentially a US-led military operation is probably our special forces. They are probably still seen and regarded as, you know, as good as anything the US has, and certainly in some of the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Whilst I'm sure there were operational commands that said they were separate, Certainly, I've read at least one book which talks about the US Special Forces operations under Stanley McChrystal when he was in Iraq, and in some respects I suspect it would have been difficult to see the difference between a US Special Forces operation and a British Forces Special Forces operations. They were basically working under the same command, with McChrystal at the top, and then having his number two was a British Special Forces officer. So that's where I think all this is going to lead to us. Yeah, I sort of think, why do we have to cut our defense spending? There are plenty of other areas where we could have cut. Probably around about $10 billion or £10 billion, around about $15 billion, that could have meant that we wouldn't have to get rid of some of these things. The other interesting thing about all of this is that we have two aircraft carriers on order, and it seems that when the contracts to build them were negotiated and placed, it became apparent that it was so onerous and would cost more for the British government to cancel the orders than it would be to continue. Which begs the question of, you know, where's our oversight in defence spending, that someone would actually sign a contract that would allow this to happen. And the other key thing is that potentially when Ark Royal goes down, could be a time when we have no aircraft to operate on our two new aircraft carriers, because with the Harrier program potentially being wound down in the United Kingdom, it's going to be a considerable period after the first carrier comes into service before we actually have aircraft that could actually run off it. So I suspect, again, it could be we might be asking the US Marines, could we have some of their maybe second-hand jump jets?
That is a very detailed explanation, and I thank you for it. And getting back to the matter of these aircraft carriers here, how long is it going to be, do you think? Maybe 5-6 years before the new carriers come online? And I do have a reason for asking that question.
It is in that kind of time frame. I think they're sort of 2017, 2018, I think, before they're fully on board, which staggers me as to how, you know, if you look at what a Korean shipyard can do from start to finish to build some of the largest container carriers in the world, do not take that kind of time. I'm just staggered why it is taking so long, but we are looking in that sort of, you know, towards the end of this decade before we're going to have two carriers that potentially will project UK foreign policy. And you know, I remember sitting on a conspiracy website, and there were some discussions regarding, oh, the French and UK militaries might share aircraft carriers, and many of us scoffed at that. But guess what? I think some of us who scoffed are basically having to eat some humble pie here and say, we might be having to share aircraft carriers with the French, who will continue to have probably at least two what I regard as proper aircraft carriers, because they have steam catapults. So that's going to be interesting if, for example, you look at France's reaction and involvement in the invasion of Iraq. I mean, they were clearly against that, so they really didn't offer anything in the initial fighting phases. So can you imagine that? You know, you have a aircraft carrier under a French aircraft carrier with maybe British aircraft on it. So who's going to decide how it's going to be used and deployed?
Now that actually ties into my first big question here. So let me phase my question in two parts here. First, how is the British public taking this defense cut proposal? And secondly, how are the politicians going to justify reducing and temporarily losing your national power projection capability? And take it with a grain of salt, but I think we're about 4 years behind you on this curve, so your answer matters to me.
So let's take the first one. What do the British people think? Well, I suspect it is the high-profile things like the two new aircraft carriers, the mothballing of Ark Royal, and probably the other interesting decision here was to not make key spending decisions on the renewal of the Trident nuclear weapon system. So in some respects, it's it's some very big things that are probably going to be occupying a lot of people in Britain. But shockingly, Justin, I think where we are from a economic point of view here, I think people are just saying, well, we're going to have to do this to cut our cloth. And, the United Kingdom does project power around the world, but I suspect its influence is far from what it was. In some respects, we do very much follow the NATO and US lines on, you know, when we will go involved in military operations, when we won't. So I think a lot of people in the United Kingdom are just saying, well, maybe this is a product of what we've had to do. Interestingly, Special Forces was one area that has not had any cut in its budget, which would suggest that comments and points made by certain senior US officials, particularly your Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who sort of raised some question marks over these defense cuts. Strangely, the thing that I believe the US value the most in the British military special forces is not going to be subject to any cuts. That to me just says that, you know, we are still seen as a very important part of NATO foreign policy, and that the fact that our special forces, be it tier one, tier two, or tier three special forces, are still seen as the best in the world and comparable. I may be a little arrogant here in saying even some respects better than what the US can offer, but that would be purely a partisan view on my approach. As for the politicians, well, I suspect there are in the UK, I think they'd be very clever in the way they've structured and revealed these cuts, in that most people in the United Kingdom are probably more interested in how the cuts will affect them at a macro level. So, you know, will it cost me my benefits? Will it cost me my job? Will we still invest in technology? Will my mother or father still get the health treatment that they need? It's only those people that I suspect are interested in the military world and the defense world who are probably even sitting up and saying, hang on a minute, all of a sudden the UK is not going to be spending as much money on defence as it once was. But however, you have to look across the world and see that we're not the only country in the world that's having to cut its cloth. I just see this as an inevitable conclusion. But certainly, I think one of the interesting things you said is that you felt that the US was 4 years behind the UK on this one. I suppose my comeback to that, Justin, would be, can the US afford to reduce its military spending? A couple of reasons for that. One is the stimulus that it puts into the US economy. The other one is the military is another extension of power projection and foreign policy, and particularly as I see that the influence of Russia is going to start to wane and the influence of China is going to continue to grow. And if you think it's particularly the US and China, it's going to be about power projection initially in the Pacific, in the Indian Ocean, and then coming through to the east coast of Africa. I suspect that that is where the US will need to spend huge amounts of money. And I've seen some reports that they are going to invest in a couple of military bases in there's one they rent from the British and its name's mistaken me, but they're going to put billions of dollars into it, upgrading some of their military bases in the Pacific. So I'm not entirely convinced, Justin, that the US will cut seriously defense spending in the same vein as the UK says, and hopefully in 4 years' time the global economies might have picked up, so the US might be able to turn around and say, well, we don't actually have to do this.
This program is brought to you by ShadowFusionBooks.com.
Well, I think I can put your mind at ease in one important respect here. You're talking about primarily here Navy and aviation cuts, which do surprise me given Britain's naval tradition. But what we're going to see here in the United States harkens back to the 1930s. Roosevelt kept the fleet, but he just cut the legs off the land forces. And whoever the next president is, be that Barack Obama, Sarah Palin, or anybody else, I think that they're going to be tempted to do the same thing. And within the context of the unusual politics going on here in the United States, because of the unpopularity of the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns, politicians are going to essentially be able to milk that and say, hey, we're downsizing the regular army. Even if it's just by 20,000 people, that's going to translate to something close to $1 trillion worth of cost savings as it's amortized over a 10-year period. So I see what you see. The issue in the Pacific, the Chinese currently have 8 nuclear submarines, and by the time your new carriers come online, they're projected to have double that number. So I want to know the same thing you want to know. Why is either country doing this?
Let's be more specific here. The governments at the time were inept, stupid, and cretinous, and allowed banks to be run by, I'm going to be absolutely candid, morons and people who really shouldn't have even been allowed to have access to pocket money, were allowed to basically do exactly what they wanted and rack up potentially huge debts for their banks, and then came waving to our governments to say, guess what, we've made some horrendous mistakes, you didn't really administer us properly, guess what, have made no secrets of this one, I would probably have let banks certainly in the United Kingdom fail, purely so that I'm not strapped with having to bail 70, 80, 100 billion pounds worth to bail out incompetently and poorly run banks. The numbers in the States are probably even bigger. I'd have personally let, you know, the US, you let one bank go, you let one bank fail. Why didn't you let others fail and just turn around and say that's part of the economy? In the UK, from a banking point of view, most small investors in banks would not have been seriously impacted. We have a scheme in the United Kingdom. I will always have to be corrected on this one, but it's somewhere between, I think it's around about £30,000, up to £30,000 is safe. The government have a scheme that guarantees it. I suspect the vast majority of people, if a bank had failed, like, for example, we'd have let Northern Rock go, yes, some people would have lost if they had more than £30,000 in the bank, but a huge number of people would not have been out of pocket. Sorry, let it go. That's the reality of life. No one coughs up when other businesses fail and say, you're too big to fail. That's the reason why we're having to make defense cuts. As for the logic of why do you reduce, certainly from the United Kingdom's perspective, when we're an island, and you know, if you want to bring anything into the United Kingdom, with the exception of the Channel Tunnel, everything has to come by sea. So why would you cut anything there? I'm inclined to agree with you on your assessment that I suspect it is the land army and the army that is potentially based on in the continental US that is probably going to suffer the biggest cuts, because if you want to project power, you need to be able to do that with naval assets and aircraft. I'm not entirely convinced that the US will go back to a sort of more isolationist strategy of saying, well, I've got a navy, but I'm going to cut its legs away. I don't see that. I actually see, certainly on your Pacific fleet, I would actually see that being at least maintained, if not increased, purely to counter what China is doing. And you know, China is looking to seriously develop its blue water fleet. Yeah, these are the kind of things that the Soviet Union struggled to actually have a viable blue water or deep water fleet. The UK and the US and France, we had the capability and we projected it. From the UK and French point of views, that's because we were both historic maritime based empires. The US purely because of where it left itself at the end of 1945, basically filled the vacuum against communism. So I don't see the US dropping its naval presences, particularly on the Pacific side. on the Atlantic side, I can probably see that they will probably either mothball or deploy, move units from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast. The aerial assets, I don't see that being dented that much. Interestingly, I would probably say that I suspect the US Marines will not suffer that much either, because if you think of how you project power, the US Marines have always been seen as they are sort of hand in glove with the Navy. The Navy potentially delivers them to a place and then they go off and fight. So I could see, you know, the National Guard maybe being reduced. I can see the Continental Army being reduced. I just don't see anything that helps project power on your Pacific coast being impacted too hard.
I can definitely work with that, because in the American case, I can definitely see how they're not going to pull back on the naval assets. And actually, in the last few years, the Navy Department has been procuring a large number of new vessels to replace older vessels. The Arleigh Burke guided missile destroyer is being replaced by the New York class, which is a substantially larger vessel, and I don't think we would need that kind of heavy lift deep water capacity unless we were seriously looking at a future conflict with China. And we've also got in development now, and actually early deployment, the Jacksonville class of LPD, Landing Platform Dock, the largest, fattest troop ship you have ever seen, a submarine commander's wet dream if ever there was one for targets. And there's no doubt in my mind at all that that stuff is really pointed at China, and you know, as a poker playing move, it's a way of just letting them know that we got our eye on you. But as these cutbacks hit U.S. land forces and now British naval forces, let's break out our crystal balls here, and you polish yours and I'll polish mine, and try to answer this one question. 10 years now out, January 1st, 2020, do the Chinese really have any reason to be afraid of us?
I'm going to say no, and I'm going to look back to history to justify that very simple no. I do not see and I think we need to broaden the discussion a little bit here and say it's not just the US. We potentially have to factor NATO into here, purely because of the NATO agreements, which says if one is attacked, all are attacked. So I think we have to broaden that discussion to say it's not just the US, it has to include NATO because of the treaty obligations there. So if we say take China and NATO, I don't see there being nose-to-nose, eyeball-to-eyeball military conflict. I would see more proxy wars, similar in concept to what the Soviet Union and the US and its NATO allies were doing, call it a Cold War. I just don't see that. A couple of reasons also to enhance that answer a little bit is, China has nuclear capability. Now, whether it has the capability to, launch missiles, you know, thousands of miles, you know, in an intercontinental fashion, I'm not entirely convinced. It has the capability. It has tested nuclear weapons. What its deployment options are of those, whether they could fire a missile from mainland China and hit, you know, the heartland of the US, that's probably more likely. If we look at a lot of NATO, that's probably a harder thing for China to do, to fire a missile that is potentially going to leave, you know, the heartland of China and land in the heartland of Europe somewhere. Certainly I suspect they have the capability to deliver weapon systems via aerial assets or naval assets. So I see that as being, as it has been against the Soviet Union, you know, the nice cliche of mutually assured destruction. You know, I just cannot see that China would do that. Simple reasons is, to take out China, I do not believe you actually need to hit China that hard with that many nuclear weapons. Basically, a lot of China's economic growth is based on the coast, based on its coastal regions. I don't think you're going to need potentially more than 10 to 15 nuclear weapons along their coast to basically obliterate their economic capability. To try and do that for the US and NATO, that's a much larger thing to do. You'd be looking at potentially hundreds of nuclear weapons to be able to do that. So I think it will be a proxy war. And strangely, I think the continent that's going to be the butt of that even harder now is going to be Africa.
Well, I don't disagree with you there. With the inroads that the Chinese are making in Africa now, we have to assume that based on what we now know about contemporary 21st century globalism, that commercial interests are towing military interest with them. And in the final minutes of our program today, I'd like to ask you one last question here. We've talked about all the hardware and the manpower that you're due to be losing here in the not too distant future. This is a subjective question, purely opinion. I know it'll be very hard to answer, but what are these cuts going to do to your intelligence gathering capability? Because the United States has already demonstrated that our existing intelligence gathering capability is really just not up to snuff. So what's it going to do to yours?
See, and that is a question that requires just a moment of thought, and I've just had that, is I do not see that certain types of intelligence gathering are going to be impacted by that. There are varying forms of intelligence, from electronic eavesdropping intelligence, that kind of thing will be reduced for UK direct operations. But this is where I went back to when I spoke that, you know, we will probably work much closer with our US and NATO allies. And I can see a concept of maybe certain parts of the NATO alliance will probably take more of a lead in certain operational areas. So if we say take out some of the electronic stuff, and I'd have to turn around and say I don't think the UK was probably a leader in signal intelligence and electronics intelligence. I suspect that we lived off a lot of what was delivered from the US. So from that point of view, I don't really see a big hit from that one. I certainly think where the US has suffered, and you know, we can point to maybe some of the decisions that have been made in the last 15 to 20 years by the US administrations, is human intelligence on the ground. And you could cite whether the CIA has been an effective use of the billions of dollars there to find that intelligence. So I think from the human intelligence on the ground, I don't think that's going to suffer, because I think, you know, that is an extension of Special Forces Tier 1, Tier 2, and also some of our more premier units on the ground is to have that capability of human intelligence and assets in certain parts of the world. So from the intelligence point of view, I don't actually see these cuts are actually going to make a huge difference to what the UK knows from its own intelligence assets. We are still going to rely heavily on what can be gained and what we can share with our NATO allies.
Well, that's a far more optimistic assessment than I'm willing to come up with at this point. So on that happy note, I'd like to say thank you for being on the program today.
My pleasure.